It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And we finally have some small number of actual results to talk about, so that's exciting. But more importantly, we have lineup decisions is really going to be the kind of main story of today. The other thing is closers, and we'll get to that in a bit. But you know, one of the things, those are really the two things you can't know from the spring. They can name a closer, but you still can't really know how guys, when they have those competitions until somebody's named, you can't tell a lot from usage in spring, and you can't tell a lot from spring lineups. So we start seeing actual lineups. And that tells us something. And I think you want to be careful not overthinking lineups. You know, it's kind of on the margins, but still worth talking about. So let's talk about a few of those. Andrew Benintendi starts in the 2 spot for the Red Sox, and Xander Bogaerts in the 6 spot. I really like Benintendi as a 2-hole hitter. I think there's a lot of ways that fits. I think it's the right thing for the Red Sox. But I also think, to kind of follow on what I was just saying a moment ago, when we're talking about the Red Sox, I'm not really overthinking any of those lineup spots because everybody in that lineup is going to hit. Every lineup, every spot in that lineup just about is a chance to drive in runs, is a chance to score runs. You know, there's not that one Mike Trout monster in the middle who's going to really change the look of things. So while it's intriguing and I like getting the extra at-bats for Benintendi, it doesn't really change anything about how I value many of any of those guys. Do you see more reason to really kind of parse out the Red Sox lineup?
I really like Benintendi hitting second for the run scored. That would be the difference for me, just because I didn't feel like he was going to probably hit like fourth or fifth, so it was probably either second or sixth or seventh. And I know you can score runs for sure from anywhere in that lineup, but I mean, hitting second is going to help maximize his plate appearances, which is good for his run score total, and just hitting in front of Betts and Hanley Ramirez and, you know, Xander Bogaerts and everything, that's going to help maximize his run score. So I like it from that perspective. I agree with you. I think it's a really good fit for him, as long as they let him run, because that is, if they give him the green light on the base pass, which I think they will do, like at least enough for him to get 15 steals, because that is part of his fantasy appeal this season, is that he can be that 5 category asset that people really like.
One of the lineup questions that I think people were most interested in, got what I think was a satisfactory resolution, at least in the Nationals opener, and that is that Adam Eaton is going to, or batted second on opening day. Doesn't necessarily mean he's going to stay there, but he batted second opening day and Jason Wirth farther down the lineup. I think just generally that's what most people wanted to see. I think that that's the best thing for the Nationals. I think that's going to be good for Bryce Harper, and I think it's going to be good for fantasy owners of Adam Eaton. It's not quite the same as the Red Sox lineup because it's not as deep, so I do think there's a little more relevance there. How does it affect your read on Eaton to know that apparently he's going to be the Nationals' number 2 hitter?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that the Nationals lineup, although very good, is not as deep as the Red Sox lineup, and part of that just being a National League lineup and having the pitcher batting. I mean, yeah, and they say it was the same thing kind of, as I mentioned, with Benintendi. With Eaton, they were looking at if he wasn't batting second. I also thought he would have been a nice fit leadoff just to break up the lefties, but either way, he was either going to be at the top or he was going to be sixth or seventh, and then from there in the National League, you're not far from just, you know, maybe one weak hitter in your lineup and then the pitcher. Yeah, this gives him a chance to score 100 runs, and I think he can hold this spot, and I think this was the right decision for them. I don't mind. I get that Jason Wirth can draw a walk still and can get on base, but he's not an everyday player at this point in his career quite the same way that Eaton is. He usually has more injury issues. He doesn't hit for average as well. You know, to me, that's real. I love that top 4, even top 5 with Rendon. I love that top 5 in Washington, maybe as much as I like any team's top 5.
It's funny, not to diverge too far from fantasy, but they talk so much about splitting up the lefties, and it seems to me that it would be a completely viable option to lead off Eaton and bat Turner second. It does not appear they're going to do that. But I've been kind of amused by this. We've got to break up the lefties. And Eaton could lead off. But
yeah,
anyway,
it did seem like Dusty Baker was, from day one, was married to the idea that Trey Turner was the leadoff hitter and that everything else would be scripted around that. So that seemed to be just a no-go as far as hitting Turner second, which I thought would be fine.
We move to another, I think, one of the bigger questions about a lineup from the spring, and that is the Orioles. There's a lot of questions as to who was going to lead off for them. The opener, it was Seth Smith, which, again, seems like a perfect fit. and makes him awfully intriguing because there aren't a lot of guys that get on base in that lineup. There are a lot of guys who hit home runs, and being on base in front of them seems like a nice little setup. How much do you like Smith?
Yeah, I think this is enough to make him interesting in 15-team leagues consistently, and I think it's enough to maybe make him interesting in a 12-team league during weeks where the Orioles are going to face a lot of right-handed pitching. The Orioles lineup to me is fascinating this year in that last year Baltimore was one of the best teams in baseball against right-handers and one of the worst teams against left-handers. And typically when that happens, I find teams go out into the offseason looking to correct that, which, for example, the Dodgers did this offseason. The Orioles didn't do that at all. They brought in Seth Smith, who's much better against right-handed hitters. They brought Pedro Alvarez back. I know he's not on the roster, but he's kind of waiting in the wings. They didn't really find a platoon partner for Smith, for Kim in the other corner. This is a lineup that could be really good against righties with Smith hitting at the top, and I think could be really weak against lefties with Smith either hitting, probably he'll have to hit lower in the lineup on those days or not play at all.
And it's funny because it hasn't been that long since we thought of the Orioles as much more a right-handed team, but that's definitely not the case now. One other lineup thing I do want to talk about, and that is kind of sleeper darling from the spring, Keon Broxton, starts the season batting sixth. He was a guy that people, you know, part of the appeal of Broxton is he can do a lot of things. There's this hope that he could get you maybe power and speed. I don't necessarily think it's a hindrance to running batting down in the lineup. In fact, sometimes I think that I'd rather, if you've got a guy like Braun, you know, I'd almost rather have Broxton batting sixth than second if I'm looking for steals, because sometimes you're not going to run in front of that power guy. So I don't mind it. Does it change your evaluation of Broxton at all if he's not a table setter in that lineup?
It doesn't really, and for two reasons. The first you touched on with him getting the green light, and I agree with you. There's that whole, you know, do you want to take the bat out of Ryan Braun's hands with a runner, at least one runner on base by sending Broxton, and you're not going to feel that way when your seventh or eighth hitters are up. So it probably won't help him with the steals. It's not going to help him, obviously, with plate appearances and with runs scored. That being said, out of all the ones we've talked about so far, like, I could see Benintendi lasting the whole season hitting second. I can see Eaton lasting hitting second. I could see Seth Smith staying at the top of the lineup. I think the Brewers lineup's going to be really fluid. I mean, Eric Thames is a really big unknown right now, and Domingo Santana is a big unknown, and Broxton's a really big unknown, too. I mean, there's skills in a lot of those players, but I think we're going to see many, many lineups from the Brewers in the first couple months, and they may never settle on something. I'm not sure.
That makes a lot of sense. No, I'm inclined to I think people should keep that in mind. And not just the Brewers, really. When you talk about several of these teams that are rebuilding, that are going to go through a lot of players, you shouldn't get too married to these notions of where people are hitting on a lot of those kinds of teams. We move to some drastic overreactions, because that's what you do when you analyze baseball in its early April. Eduardo Nunez, two steals on opening day, was a definite source of speed last year, seems to have some opportunity, seems to have an opportunity, seems like he's going to play. I still don't think anybody thinks he's going to hit 16 home runs again, but, you know, he's a lifetime 275 hitter. It wouldn't be shocking if he hit 270, 280 again. And with that and regular playing time on a team that's not going to have a great offense, I don't think they're going to have a bad offense, but Nunez is a guy people were kind of cold on, and I'm cold on him, but you raise, is he a threat to steal 40 again? And I'd probably take the under on that, but, you know, I'd probably take the over on 30. Did we sell Nunez too short in spring and in the offseason?
I think maybe a little bit, and I think that happens with late bloomers. And I understand why, like track record matters. So, for me, Nunez is a late bloomer, but as you said, his career batting average is totally solid. Like, he can hit singles, and I don't think he's a 16 home run hitter either, but he could be an 8 home run hitter who hits 270 even or something like that and steals 30 to 35 bases. And the way the steals are right now across the majors, you know, there's a fair amount of value there. And most importantly, I think if he's hitting around 270, he could just keep his job, which gives him the opportunity to steal bases. So I think that, yeah, a lot of people were projecting like a cliff, like a big fall off from him and just him being like a one-year wonder. I believe that last season will be the best season of his career, but I don't think there's a total cliff there. And the Giants are set up kind of maybe for his skill set. That's a big park where the fact that he can hit the ball, you know, put the ball in play and steal bases makes him maybe valuable to a team like that.
Yep. And one other thing, for one more year, he's eligible at shortstop. He probably won't be next year, but he does have that eligibility at short and third, which adds a little bit of value. Michael Brantley appears to be good to go. He's playing the field. He is, at this moment, we have not seen any yellow lights, yellow flags. I have a kind of a permanent yellow flag attached to him personally. I remain really concerned about him in the anything but this week term, and I think my feeling on Michael Brantley, if I had him, was I would be hoping that he had a hot couple of weeks and maybe look to flip him, because I just worry so much about how he comes back in the long run for that. I wonder how he holds up in a full year back. I am basically the perpetual pessimist on Michael Brantley. Do you have more optimism? Are you cheered by a day or two? Has nothing changed because it's only a day or two? Where are you on him?
I'm going to say that I'm getting a little more optimistic just because he made it back for opening day. I was skeptical that that would even happen. And I used to love Michael Brantley as a hitter, like pre-2016. So especially he's hitting third, too. So that interests me, too, just in his ability to compile runs and RBIs. And I think he can still hit singles and doubles. The dividing line for him, really, for fantasy, there'll be two things. Obviously, can he stay healthy and play 130 or 40 at least games this year? The other thing will be, you know, does he still have some power, and can he still steal bases? Because he was never amazing at both those things. Like, he has 120 homer season in his career. He has 120 steal season in his career. He's turning 30 soon. If he drops, if these injuries have robbed him of some power, and now he's kind of like a 10-homer player, 12-homer player, and if he doesn't run the bases as aggressively, or he's not quite as fast as he used to be, and now he's kind of a 10 or 12 steal guy, and he's a 290 or 300 hitter, like, that's okay, but in a mixed league, it's not great, right? So
yep.
That would be my concern, is can he still be like a high teens or 20 homer and steal player? And I don't think we're going to know that, at least for a little while.
And that's really the thing that worries me, is I'm pretty bearish on the power returning. And again, the other thing, I don't want to hammer this too hard, but when you have those kinds of injuries that sap a hitter's strength, whether it's a wrist, whether it's a shoulder, you know, it's things other than pulled muscles or obliques or those kind of things. When you get those kind of injuries that are really to areas that are kind of central to what a hitter does and that affect strength and power, one of my worries, and we've seen this with guys before, is that it's one thing to gear up, to get healthy in spring and have a good first month, and it's quite another to maintain that over 6 months. And so and it's not just him, but one of my sort of things I always keep in mind with those kinds of injuries, and I think particularly with hitters, it's hands and wrists and shoulders. I think it's a lot easier to come back and be strong for a month from something like that than it is to hold up over 6 months. So, again, where I am on him is if I have him and I see something I like early, I'm probably looking to flip him while the value is high.
Yeah, I also wanted to mention on Brantley, to me he's an interesting visual in the fact that power is up across baseball, basically, and he missed the power spike. So when he was in his prime hitting 15 or 20 homers, power was down a bit, right, 2013, 14, 15, and the 15 or 20 homers looked decent. With all the power we saw last season, I mean, you know, Rajay Davis hit 12 homers last season. So now him hitting 12 homers this year is, like, really light for an outfielder if players are going to hit home runs the way they hit them last season. So that was one of the things that made him really attractive a couple years ago, is there just weren't that many 30-homer hitters out there. So him being high teens or 20 was totally fine. Now it does look really light compared to what's available in the outfield.
That is a fair point. Speaking of outfielders, Jacob May is, as of now, the starting center fielder for your Chicago White Sox. I'm bummer guy again. I'm bummer guy for most of this episode again. That's twice in, I think, 3 weeks. But I see the steals, but I see a guy who, in high A at 22, hit .258 and slugged .395. I see a guy who in double A at age 23, hit .275 and slugged .334. I see a guy who had a .309 on base in AAA last year. And I see, it's one of the things we talked about, I talked about last week, is I just have a really hard time, unless it's just bargain, absolute basement, going for speed for guys who I'm not sure can hit. And I'm just not at all sure that May can hit. And so unless it's just last guy, last pickup, I need steals, pure tactical move, I'm saying no to a guy who hasn't proved he can hit a triple A, never mind the major leagues. And so this is the point where, once again, I ask you, am I being unfair, or is it reasonable to be pretty cold on May?
Yeah, no, in this case, I'm totally with you. I think he's going to be stuck at the bottom of the lineup, too. For me, he's like a low-end, like a $1 or $2 or waiver wire grab in an AL-only league. And maybe he gets you 15 steals if he holds that job. You know, I don't know. We'll see what they do with Charlie Tilson when he comes back. That's a long way off, and he also is very inexperienced. So, yeah, I could see him maybe getting 15 steals this year, but also hitting .235 or something like that with no power. So,
right.
Yeah, not. I wouldn't pick him up in a mixed league.
So let's go to a guy I do like, and that's Steve Pierce. I like the skill set. I like the fit in a good lineup. I like the ballpark. And now I like the opportunity. And again, we should never forget that a lot of this is personal, and we're having fun here. And Pierce is a guy I liked as a college hitter at South Carolina a lifetime ago. So, you know, these things factor in. But I like Pierce a lot, and it looks like he has a real nice opportunity. It looks like the Blue Jays are going to find, you know, maybe not 500 at-bats, but maybe 500 plate appearances for him. Just based on a couple of days' worth of opportunities here, have you adjusted your read on Pierce for the year? Just, again, based on opportunity. I don't think we're adjusting what we think about his skill set, but the opportunity might be more than we thought.
Yeah, I've been really high on Pierce all spring. He was actually on our, like, MLB.com fantasy cheat sheet as as the first base sleeper all through spring training. I just think he's a, like, just stepping back and looking at this, like, kind of from a holistic perspective, he's a better hitter than Justin Smoke, who he's competing with at first base. He's a better hitter than Ezekiel Carrera, who's the other option in left field. I know there's some concerns about his ability to throw from left field, but either way, I feel like the Blue Jays lineup, and that I also heard some comments, like Russ Atkins said early in spring training, they would love it if he could just become their left fielder. And, you know, and then seeing him in the lineup on opening day against a right-handed starter, which is kind of what Smoke maybe was going to do at first base, I don't know. To me, that drove the point home that I think we're going to see Pierce in the lineup much more often than not, probably, say, 5 out of 6 games a week. He's an injury risk. He has been on the DL plenty of times for a part-time player in his career, but I think he could be a sneaky source of 25 home runs this year, and you know, and a respectable batting average, and could maybe even move up in the lineup at some point if they have an injury or if some players are underperforming.
Sure. We move to starting pitchers, and Tyler Glasnow gets a rotation spot in Pittsburgh. I certainly have my concerns, but I also don't think you have to go crazy to get him. And that potential strikeout rate is pretty appealing. I'm sure they do have to face the Cubs, but overall, Pittsburgh is a place where I like starters. They're going to handle him well. They're going to get him out without pushing him too far. I like Glasnow a lot. How far up the format ladder do you go before you're not intrigued by Tyler Glasnow?
Yeah, I agree with you that the buzz on him making the rotation was really small, which I was surprised. There was more buzz when he was called up last year, which we see often. You know, they get called up the first time, everybody goes crazy, they don't perform especially well at the beginning, and then people just kind of are off until they actually show something. But I'm worried about his lack of control in the walks. So for that reason,
absolutely,
I wouldn't want him in my lineup right now. But to me, he's the perfect guy to have on your bench, even in a shallow league, like a 10-team league, a 12-team league. Like, instead of having a Mike Leake type on your bench, someone who you know there's just not much potential there, why not have Glasnow, who may be really, really good? And if he's walking, you know, 3, 4, 5 batters start, then you could cut him in a couple weeks.
Yeah, that's the thing, is for those kinds of spots, I want the guy, and I think we talked about this early last year, when I'm talking about those places on my roster and those kinds of leagues, I can stream guys later in the year. If I'm using that spot right now, Mike Leake's going to be available in a 10-team mix, or somebody equivalent to him is going to be available. If I can pick up somebody now who I might hold all year, that's what I want to do with that roster spot.
Yeah, Glasnow and Hyunjin Ryu are two of my favorites right now for those last spots in shallow leagues, just in that Ryu, huge injury risk, but when he's been healthy has always been effective, and Glasnow with that potential to get you, you know, more than a strikeout per inning. I think those are really nice ways to go, and just don't use them for their initial starts and see what happens.
A guy who was just blistering hot all spring and then ugly on opening day, Masahiro Tanaka. I say no concern. He's fine. He's good. He's a good pitcher. He's going to be fine. I have no worry. Did his clunker raise any alarm bells for you?
No, not really. And I watched most of that start, and I felt like he even had a little bit of bad luck, you know, a ground ball up the middle that just doesn't find a glove, and that could have maybe helped him get out of an inning. I think we see that, like, and we overreact early in the season, but like he didn't give up four home runs. Like, in most pitchers, good pitchers like Tanaka, if they have a bad start, you can look back at a couple times where you think, oh, okay, if that ball had been a few feet in either direction, you know, he gets out of the inning and this stat line doesn't look so bad. I think he's fine. I don't think he's quite a buy low yet because the spring was really good. But if he wasn't great in his next start, then he might be a really nice buy low candidate.
Yep. And then while we're overreacting, because again, overreacting is the name of the game. And I think the thing is, at this point, confirmation bias is really the name of the game. You know, I don't think you're changing opinions. But I think I'm not as opposed to that as some people are. If you liked a guy and you get another data point, then, hey, keep liking him. That definitely applies to Carlos Martinez. I like Carlos Martinez a lot. I liked him before opening day. He goes and shoves against the Cubs, and I like him maybe even a little bit more. We talked about Martinez, I think, as a potential breakout guy. Look, one start doesn't change your view on him, but how much did you like seeing what you saw from him?
Yeah, I mean, obviously really impressive. And to me, the big thing is that it was against one of the best lineups in baseball.
Yep.
I mean, you know, I said that it was the most impressive pitching performance of any pitcher on the opening day, counting Sunday or Monday. I'll include Clayton Kershaw's great start in that because we knew Kershaw would dominate the Padres. But Martinez against the Cubs is really good. The Cubs are a tough lineup. That being said, there are a lot of Cubs hitters that strike out a fair amount. So him getting a lot of strikeouts against the Cubs is not totally shocking. The zero walks, you know, is what impressed me. That's the real thing. His career whip is 1.28, and a lot of that is because his walk rate's fairly high. It's not really ace-like. If he can bring his walk rate down, now we could be talking. If you get that whip in the 1.1, 1.15 even, and then maybe his ERA pushes below 3, now we could be looking at something really special.
Two more starters before we move on. Garrett Cole, there was some concern about him coming into this year. He had a rough year last year. I think a lot of people were viewing him as a bounce-back slash breakout candidate. It was Fenway. You kind of want to be cautious and say, you know, are we docking a guy just because he had a rough start in a very tough place to pitch, or is there reason for concern? What's your concern meter on Cole after one start?
Really low right now, just because as you said, it's Fenway, it's the Red Sox lineup, and most importantly with him, that's not his typical type of competition. So if Cole was a pitcher on the Orioles this year, I'd say, okay, this is trouble. He's going to meet that team again in Toronto again in New York and pitch at Yankee Stadium. But, I mean, he's going to go back to National League lineups. I mean, maybe it's a little bit of a sign that if you were expecting Garrett Cole to be a $10 pitcher at your auction but then perform like a $25 pitcher, maybe that's not going to happen because I'm sure Max Scherzer could have gone in there probably and done fine. Maybe he's not going to maybe get quite back to where he was in that great 2015 season, but I think Cole's an interesting maybe buy low right now just because his owner, when he drafted him, was a little unsure about him, and then he wasn't great in opening day. He could be a really nice candidate. If his next start is 6 innings, 3 or 4 runs, maybe then you could go in and get him for a discount.
And one last starter, Dallas Keuchel, very encouraging opening day. I'm still not sure what to make of him. I wasn't sure what to make of him off of his best season. I wasn't sure what to make up of him off of his struggling season last year. So I'm still not sure what to make of him. But I'm kind of looking for reasons to buy, and I would say his first start counted somewhat in that regard. What did you think of Keuchel's debut?
Yeah, it looked pretty good, and then the Mariners didn't look good against him, and they didn't look good again in the second game. If what I would be looking for Keuchel is he was working down in the strike zone, and I'm hoping that he can get back, not to the 2015 level. I think that's an unrealistic expectation. Could he get back to the 2014 level? That was a 2.93 ERA. I don't think he can get quite there, but a 1.18 whip. And that's kind of what I'm looking for from him. I mean, injuries were a part of the story for him last season. Can he get back to keeping the ball down, inducing a lot of ground balls, not giving up many home runs? That's who he was in 2014, and a good pitcher. So maybe like a 3.4, 3.3, 3.4 ERA and a whip around 1.15 or 1.20. I think that would be nice. That's a nice, like, number two or three, maybe number three starter in a mixed league.
In a moment, we will talk closers, but before we switch over to that topic, we want to take a moment to tell you about the Cut Forecast. Cut Forecast is the podcast from the staff of MLB.com's Cut 4 section, which focuses on the lighter side of baseball. If you have made it this far into our podcast, we think you will enjoy it. Make you laugh, you might learn something about baseball dogs or ballpark food. By the way, those are two separate things, dogs as in dogs, not hot dogs. Last week's episode included a chat with Isla Borders, who was the first woman to start and win a men's professional baseball game. Sounds like the kind of thing you might be into? Search Cut Forecast, C-U-T, the number 4, C-A-S-T, in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcast, and click subscribe. This is a great time. Just as spring training was, opening week is a great time for Cut 4. A lot of fun stuff going around, a lot of getting to know guys' personalities, a lot of great stories about guys making clubs, so this is a good time for Cut 4.
Yeah, I love the ballpark food being in there, because I've seen more tweets about new ballpark foods in the past couple of weeks. I feel like that becomes more and more of a thing every year lately.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it's just social media, but it's becoming where stadiums are trying to be more creative or better, and fans are really interested in that. I don't know. It's just a fun topic, especially if you can't get to every park, just seeing what's happening at all of them.
I'll be reporting from SunTrust Park soon. So,
okay. Full wrap-up on what they offer.
We move to closers, and we have had some rough outings by some guys we might have thought were pretty safe. Blown saves, and some we didn't. Blown saves by Mark Melancon, Fernando Rodney, and Sung Wan Oh. Sam Dyson gave up 3 runs. Jeanmar Gomez gave up 2 runs and had an almost blown save. My feeling on this is that, for the most part, the guys we knew we were worried about, we're still worried about. The guys we weren't, we're not. I think the only potential exception to this would be Melancon, because he's the one guy to me that, you know, he's not the absolute overpowering guy that some of these, that the perceived elite closers are. He's the one guy that it wouldn't shock me if it went really south quickly. I'm not saying it's going to happen. It's one game. I'm not overreacting. But that's the one guy where I kind of have it in the back of my mind, and just the itchy trigger finger Bruce Bochy had last year. That's the one where I'm watching closely. You know, look, I was never going to touch Fernando Rodney in Arizona, no matter what, no chance, no way, no how. And we agree that Jeanmar Gomez was a guy that we didn't have a lot of faith in. But Melancon, to me, is a watch closely. Am I being unfair or too quick to put him in that category?
Actually, I think it goes right back to when we were talking starting pitchers, and you talked about kind of like the confirmation bias, or that, you know, what we're getting. So Melancon's someone who you kind of have had on your radar. You've mentioned that before, is someone who you're just wary of. He's probably not your pick among that tier of closers. So when he blows the save, that confirms kind of your reservations about him. I've been pretty comfortable with him. I felt like a couple years ago, early in the season, there was some talk about his velocity being down, and people in my league were really wary of him, and then I kind of got into that, and then he turned out to be great and had a ton of saves and pitched really well. I think he'll be okay, especially when he's at home. I don't know. I just feel like Melancon will be fine. For me, my confirmation bias, my story is Sam Dyson, just because I'm wary of him.
Yep.
I know he gets a lot of ground balls, and he had a lot of saves last season, but he's not totally that closer profile in my mind, and they just have some really nice options, some guys who can get more strikeouts behind him in their bullpen. So for me, even though he didn't blow a save, basically lost them a game, that was the one where I'm really keeping an eye on, and whether Matt Bush gets a shot or they go to Jeffress. But I'm interested to see what happens with Dyson in the next couple weeks. But that's the thing with closers. As you said, neither one of us wanted Rodney or Gomez already. Right. I still feel really confident in O. Yeah, I think that's a really good example of the guys you were wary of, you're still wary of. And if you weren't wary of a guy, you shouldn't be wary of him after one blown save, right, no matter when it happens.
Who are you watching in some of those places where we don't think the guy is going to last? I think Matt Bush is kind of the obvious guy there. I think Nerys was kind of the obvious guy, I think, in Philly. But Ramos is a really intriguing arm. Benoit has certainly done it before. Is there anybody in Phoenix or in Philly that you like maybe more than Matt Bush as we start hedging on who might be the next man up?
Yeah, no one in Arizona. With the Phillies, yeah, I really like Nerys. At the same time, I could see an organizational perspective on using Benoit. I mean, he's the veteran. He has had closer experience. He's also on a short contract and would build up a lot of trade value by picking up, say, 15 saves by the middle of July. So if they needed to go to someone, I could see them going to the older pitcher, the one with experience. So I'd love to own both, but that's not really possible in a lot of leagues. But if I could, I'd love to own both of them because I really just don't believe that. I didn't believe it all last season either, and he defied my expectations for a long time. But I don't believe that Gomez has closer material.
The Angels claim that they are going by committee. I will believe that Mike Socha uses a ninth inning committee when I see it for more than a couple of weeks. I think somebody is going to end up being the guy there, and so I still think the question is, who is that guy? Bedrosian, Bailey, Street. Boy, I still think if I'm laying odds, I still might take Street as the guy with the most saves on that club at the end of the year. Bedrosian's certainly the pitcher I like the most, but I don't trust that it's a committee, and I don't trust that he doesn't end up going to the capital P, capital C proven closer. Who do you like in that mix?
Yeah, I'm going to go down a limb here, and my prediction is going to be that Bedrosian gets 35 saves this year, and, you know, Street basically gets none, and Bailey basically doesn't get any either. I think Bedrosian got the first save chance yesterday. He converted it just fine. I have a feeling that he's a good enough pitcher that by the time Street gets back, he has a handful of saves. I'm just not convinced that Street will totally be 100%, you know, version of himself, like in the first half or maybe at all this year. So I think Bedrosian is someone who I don't know if you can still buy low on him, but I think you kind of can because he hasn't really been named the closer. If I was looking for a cheap save source that could possibly be really, really good, that's the one that I want to go after.
Do you agree, sounds like we do agree, that one way or another there aren't going to be three guys with 12 saves in Anaheim this year?
Yeah, totally. I feel like Bedrosian has, however long it takes Street to get back, to convince Mike Socha that he's an awesome closer. And if he's 5-for-5 and save chances when Street gets back, then Socha, I think, will, and you know, it has an ERA of 1 or something like that, then I think Socha just rolls with him. You know, if he blows, but he's got those few weeks to say, because as you said, Street's the proven closer, but I could see Bedrosian pitching so well that, and especially after Street was ineffective last season, that Socha says, well, I've got to go with him.
One last closer before we move to our two-start pitchers. Greg Holland, so far so good. You any more at ease about him than a couple of weeks or a month ago?
Yeah, I think a little more at ease. I mean, those saves that he got this week were not at Coors Field. But his velocity has gone in the right direction since we initially talked about him near the beginning of spring training. So that makes me a little more at ease of him. That being said, we're at about 25 years of history with the Rockies and very, very few seasons where they've produced a really helpful mixed league closer. And I'm willing to be wrong still on Holland. I am a little more optimistic on him, but I think year in, year out, unless they ever got a Chapman type closer, I'm willing to just miss our Rockies 38 save closer because it just doesn't happen that often.
We now move on to the two start pitchers, and it's a really interesting set of names this week. Taijuan Walker on the road, Giants and Dodgers. Tyler Chatwood home for the Padres and at the Giants. Charlie Morton at Seattle and at Oakland. Ian Kennedy home for Oakland, home for the Angels. Michael Pineda home for Tampa Bay and St. Louis. Jarrell Cotton at Kansas City, home for Houston. Jared Eichhoff, home for the Mets and at Washington, Alex Cobb at Yankee Stadium and at Fenway. To me, there are definitely a couple of guys that jump out here. I really like Charlie Morton on the road. I really like Michael Pineda at home, especially with one of those against the Rays. And I'm definitely intrigued by Cotton in Kansas City and at home. Do you have a favorite from those guys, and do you have anybody that I didn't list that you particularly like?
Yeah, actually, for my favorite's Taiwan Walker. I really like him for two. I like him for two National League starts, because that's one of the reasons he's appealing. He's in the National League now that aren't at Chase Field. So get him in San Francisco, get him in L.A. I'm interested in that. I really like Eichhoff and Cotton. Those would probably be my next two. And I threw Chatwood on the list. I don't know if I would have the guts to use Chatwood, but I'll say this. He was really, really good on the road last season, and that's one of his starts in San Fran. And then his home starts against the Padres, and I'm so not scared of the Padres lineup that I would, in a 15-team league, consider giving him that chance.
That makes sense to me. All right. That's Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everybody, for taking the time to listen, and thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk.